Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
State of uncertainty. Now that the Obama administration can't count on the Senate for health care reform, suddenly even the confirmation of the Fed chairman feels like heavy lifting.
President Obama checked in with the leadership over the weekend, and he heard from Senator Reid that there is a lot of support for Ben Bernanke. We are confident that the chairman will be confirmed.
In this State of the Union week, the White House trying to make sure of one thing.
We don't get fooled again.
Tomfoolery and political miscalculation on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, January 25th, and The Takeaway is, did they get fooled there at the White House, or was it foolish to kind of drop the ball on all the events that happened last week?
I think both. Both, actually. But let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. President Obama will use his first State of the Union address on Wednesday night to focus on creating jobs, addressing the deficit, and helping middle-class families. He'll set the tone later this morning when he announces a series of economic initiatives aimed at helping struggling middle-class families.
For more on the president's upcoming speech, we're joined by Bruce Reed, author of The Plan, Big Ideas for America. Good morning, Mr. Reed.
Good morning.
So after last week, Americans either don't particularly want President Obama's ideas or his ideas aren't big enough. Which do you think it is?
Americans still like President Obama's ideas. They just don't like what Congress has done with them. And they want to see him make good on the biggest idea of his campaign to change Washington.
Well, we're going to explore if the administration can stay on message anticipating the State of the Union speech on Wednesday. We'll be back with Bruce Reed in just a moment.
In Haiti, truckers filling mass graves report 150,000 bodies have been buried so far. And international aid workers are now setting up tent cities outside Port-au-Prince for earthquake refugees. But there's a shortage of tents right now, with hundreds of thousands more needed. This wealthy Haitian businessman says the earthquake was a leveler in more way than one.
We're all looking at the terrible situation in your country, and the task ahead of you is unimaginable. I say this, Sean Max, as a fellow prime minister. I just can't imagine, but you know that our government is with you.
That's actually the Canadian prime minister speaking to his counterpart from Haiti. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is among the world leaders in Montreal this morning to discuss how to improve aid to Haiti and its long-term reconstruction. In Baghdad this morning, at least 31 people are dead after car bombs exploded near three hotels popular with Western journalists and businessmen.
A possible change in strategy, or at least an intriguing story out of Afghanistan this morning. The top U.S. commander there says negotiating with the Taliban may be the best way to end the war. General Stanley McChrystal tells the U.K.'s Financial Times there's been enough fighting and the Taliban could help run the country in the future under some kind of political solution. President Obama hopes the deployment of 30,000 extra troops to Afghanistan will weaken the Taliban enough to force some kind of a peace deal. With one kick, it was party time in the Big Easy last night.
Snap, placement, kick by Hartley, and it is done! It's good!
And the New Orleans Saints, a team that was homeless after Hurricane Katrina, are going to their first Super Bowl. They beat the Minnesota Vikings in overtime last night and will meet Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts in the Super Bowl in 2 weeks. The Colts have an early 4-point favorite, according to oddsmakers. Asian and European markets down, futures up. The Dow gets underway at 10,172 in about a half hour. The S&P opens at 1,091 and the NASDAQ at 2205. We're welcoming our expanded listening audience right here in New York. Starting this week, we're on for 4 full hours every morning on our home station, WNYC AM 820. Coming up, what is the next stage for health care reform? The New York Times' David Leonard talks to us.
And we're asking, how would you describe the state of our union? We're hearing from a number of people this week, like General David Petraeus, about it. We want to hear from you. Edmund writes to our site, thetakeaway.org, tell me when to celebrate. It's only 5 words. Mitch emails us, divided we fell, united we'll stand. And Carl emails us, we accept sound bites as fact. Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or at our site, thetakeaway.org. See if you can do it in just 6 words. Coming up next, what can President Obama do to address the myriad of problems that he faces?
Good morning, everyone. Well, if there was a draft of the president's State of the Union address that was written and circulating before last week, no doubt that draft is in the garbage right about now. The administration seems to be scrambling to find another message now that health care reform is not going to be passed, certainly, by Wednesday. And the question of where it goes from here is certainly up in the air. What is the new message? How can the administration get on message? And will we get glimpses of the new message from the Obama administration in the State of the Union address on Wednesday? Joining us now is Bruce Reed, CEO of the Democratic Leadership Council and co-author of the 2006 book, The Plan, Big Ideas for America. He wrote it with Rahm Emanuel, who, of course, is Barack Obama's chief of staff. Good morning once again, Bruce.
Good morning.
And Raihan Salam joins us. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation, co-author of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Welcome back to the program, Raihan.
Thanks for having me.
Bruce, let me begin with you. It seems to me as though the setback last week was all about repudiating the DLC's kind of approach to things. Obama kind of led with the banks, did a sort of centrist approach to reassure the financial community, worked on all kinds of compromises with conservatives and health care reform, and the people of Massachusetts said, we're impatient, this isn't working, what about jobs?
Well, I don't think it was a repudiation. I think it was in part about jobs. I think the country wants to see the president change Washington. They want to see him tell Congress where to take the country, not cut deals. I think that means they want him to tackle some of the other long-term problems as well, like the deficit.
Now, that calls for a much more aggressive speech on Wednesday than we're hearing from our partners, the New York Times, who says we've got some modest proposals. Nothing big is going to be rolled out on Wednesday, it looks like.
Well, I think he has two jobs to do on Wednesday. He needs to lay out his priorities for the year on how to help the middle class with jobs and help for college and finishing the job on health care. And then second, he needs to reassure Americans that he wants to make government better, not bigger, and show how he's going to take on long-term fiscal responsibility and change in Washington.
All right. Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation, co-author of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class. How is this an opportunity for Republicans other than simply saying, yeah, see, it didn't work for them, come to us? What's the program? What's the manifesto? I'm not hearing one.
I think that it allows Republicans to pivot from a position of opposition to a position in which they say, hey now, you know, we basically have what we want. We're scaling back some of these big and overambitious plans, and now we can cooperate with Democrats to get moving on a couple of priorities for American voters. That's not necessarily what they will do, but it is an opportunity, and if they seize it, then it will really confuse and scramble the political strategy of the White House.
Now, confusing and scrambling seems to have been one accomplishment of at least some in the GOP. But Barack Obama got elected on a message of change, which seems to me to be a bipartisan message. You say people are reassured by moving back from these overambitious plans. Where's the change in the GOP's message?
The change in the GOP's message is not quite there. Really, what has to happen is the Republican Party has to regain the trust of voters, including lots of conservative independents, that they lost. One thing that's important to keep in mind is a lot of these, you know, so-called Tea Party activists are people who voted for Democrats in 2006. A lot of them stayed home in 2008. And the truth is that the mainstream of the Republican Party, the leadership in Congress, doesn't necessarily resonate with these guys. It's more a matter of anger and distrust regarding the folks who are in power right now. So the Republicans have to actually do things that are affirmative to win back that trust. And as far as the manifesto, I'd say their manifesto is really not very clear because, again, you're talking about a party that's trying to win elections in a very diverse country where there are a lot of disagreements. And so it's very easy to focus on opposition. That's something that you see with regard to any party that's an out party. And I think that they're enjoying that. They're taking advantage of it. But it's not something that's going to work forever.
And it's not something that's going to clear the air of frustration that White House advisor David Axelrod told ABC News on This Week yesterday was not a surprise.
I said to him a year ago, Mr. President, your numbers are going to be considerably worse a year from now than they are today, because you can't govern in an economy like this without great disaffection. And that's what's happened.
Now, Bruce Reed from the DLC, David Axelrod, of course, is a student of history. But in Franklin Roosevelt's second term, he was able to gain seats by focusing on a full court press against the financial community, against the sort of financial underpinnings of the United States, and going all out on jobs. Is there any opportunity for the president to do something like that? And you're a student of history as well.
Well, I think he has an opportunity to learn from this last setback. And the cycle will turn. When the economy recovers, Democrats will do better. But this is a tough time to govern, and it's important to be patient with the ideas that he believes in and impatient with the way Washington works.
But I guess that's what some people are frustrated with. The cycle will turn, the economy will turn around, the Democrats will be back in. That bespeaks a certain passivity, and I think people are looking for Barack Obama for precisely the kind of radicalism and we're rolling up our sleeves that he campaigned on.
No, I think they want they like him because he levels with them, and he can rail against the banks all he wants to, but that isn't going to translate into a bunch of jobs. It isn't going to mean that that people have more money to pay for college or childcare or help their parents. So, you know, I think it is important to rein in the financial sector and pass the reforms that that he's promised to make sure that we don't have another financial crisis. But it's also important to rein in Washington.
All right, so campaigning against Washington, projecting reassurance to the American people, part of the agenda for Barack Obama as he prepares his State of the Union address. Bruce Reed, CEO of the DLC and co-author of the 2006 book, The Big Ideas for America, and Raihan Salam of the New America Foundation also joined us.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans, the State of our Union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
Which is why we want you to get involved. What's your State of the Union speech? You can deliver it in less than a minute at 877-8-MY-TAKE or six words or less at takeaway.org. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check back in on stories we're following.
Haiti's main creditors meet today in Montreal to map out a plan for the country's reconstruction. The Canadian Minister for Foreign Affairs, Lawrence Cannon, had this to say.
Together with the government of Haiti, we need to roll up our sleeves and begin to lay the groundwork for the enormous task ahead. We want to get it done right.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the Haitian Prime Minister are among the international leaders at today's meeting. And as we've been discussing, the president will give his first State of the Union address on Wednesday. Aides say he'll use the address to refocus his presidency after a series of setbacks. This morning, the president will lay out more plans for an economic rebound at a meeting of the White House Middle Class Task Force.
No survivors have been found after an Ethiopian Airlines plane caught fire after taking off from Beirut's airport and plunging into the Mediterranean Sea. 23 bodies have been recovered. In Iraq, police say the death toll has jumped to 31 following three blasts in a hotel district in downtown Baghdad. Also in the country, a government spokesman says Saddam's cousin, Chemical Ali, has just been executed.
I'd like to talk to you about a fresh start on a new world. You'd be making a difference.
Entertainment news there. At the box office, James Cameron's Avatar is on a course to sink Titanic's record. The movie took number one for the sixth straight weekend.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, what do you think is the state of the country?
One that's bleak, but one that's also lined with hope.
We look ahead to the State of the Union address later this week, and we want to know what you think. Tell us in six words or less at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
So hold your horses, sports fiends. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has our sports takeout in just a moment. But first, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
So it seems as though the Democrats in the House and Senate are looking for a victim, and they may have found a victim in Ben Bernanke. Listen to Robert Gibbs speaking on Fox News Sunday.
I think now would be a particularly bad time to send a signal to the international community and to our overall financial system by playing politics in any way with this upcoming vote.
Referring to the confirmation vote for reconfirmation vote for Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, and the translation of that would be, it's a great time for playing politics with this. What's going on, Todd?
There was opposition to Ben Bernanke for Fed chairman mounting before the Democrats lost in Massachusetts and had this gigantic oh my gosh moment. And ever since then, it's mounted. But the opposition, John, isn't just coming from liberals in the Senate, although it is coming from there. There are holds on Bernanke from all over the map, from Bernie Sanders of Vermont all the way over to the far right, Jim DeMint of South Carolina, and several senators in between. So you saw several leading senators over the weekend dashing off statements and rushing to Bernanke's defense. So now Harry Reid, the majority leader, and Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, not to mention Chris Dodd and Judd Gregg, all powerful senators in the either leaders or the banking area, saying he should be supported, and McConnell predicting that he would get through this week, although it's not going to be nearly as close as the administration, I'm sure, had hoped. Nothing is certain now after this loss in Massachusetts and faltering health care. So they're rushing to his defense this week, that's for sure.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
And now on to sports. Well, we know who's going to the Super Bowl.
And it's picked off. Off the deflection, Kelvin Hayden has the interception. And the Colts have all but locked up a berth in the Super Bowl.
Joining us now is Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So the Indianapolis Colts beat the New York Jets 30-17 in the AFC Championship.
Well, check this out. Third quarter, Pierre Garçon, the Haitian but New York-born kid, the wide receiver for the Colts, he comes off the line, he shakes the Jets defender, he makes him see a ghost, he creates a space, and then he underneath which Peyton Manning drops the ball for the go-ahead touchdown, and the Colts never looked back. They scored 24 points. They were down 17-6. They raced to the end, and 30-17 was the final score.
But Jets fans aren't you know necessarily sad today. That team did okay.
There's a difference between confidence and momentum, and the Jets came into this game with momentum. The Indianapolis Colts had confidence. They didn't need to. You know, they rested their starters, but they didn't need to worry about anything else. They didn't have to talk. The Jets fans had the momentum that built their confidence, but really at the end of the day, it was the confidence of the Colts and of Peyton Manning that proved to win the day.
Now, and the other team that's going is the Saints, the New Orleans Saints. I'm sure that's a crowd favorite just in terms of the emotional recovery after Katrina. What about this matchup?
Well, first of all, the Saints are not they are now America's team. They no more is it Dallas, no more is it any other team. It's not even the Yankees, it's New Orleans Saints. After what happened in Katrina, now and what happened in the Superdome in general, now you have the curses were exterminated in that victory yesterday. Garrett Hartley
over the Minnesota Vikings.
Exactly,
right?
Over the Vikings. Garrett Hartley, when he kicked that game winning field goal in overtime, 31-28. What he had visioned it the night before. He called his dad at 2 a.m. and he said, I have a feeling I'm going to kick the game-winning field goal from 42 yards out on the right hash. And it happened exactly that way. So you got to give it to – there was something going on in Bourbon Street yesterday.
A little voodoo there?
A little something happening.
So you're declaring the Saints are America's team?
They're America's team.
Well, but are you declaring them the winner of the Super Bowl?
I'm not going to go that far.
Favoring the Colts.
I'm going to go with the Colts because I think Peyton Manning is on a mission. And I think if you might remember I said it before that the Colts were a team of destiny. I got a little sidetracked by the euphoria of the Jets. But now I'm back down to earth, and I'm feeling these Colts right now.
Twice in the Super Bowl in the last 4 years.
Correct.
Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
So, you know, it says in the Constitution that presidents must in some way report to the Congress, and by implication the American people, about the State of the Union. Well, it's become an annual speech. It gets delivered this week by the president. But the Constitution says nothing about on this radio program, asking you what you think. And it's not going to prevent us from saying, call 8778-MY-TAKE with your assessment of the country. If you go to our website, thetakeaway.org, try to do it in 6 words or less. On the phone, do it in a minute or less. But to get the conversation going, we decided to get in touch with some of the memorable voices on the program over the past year. Citizens like Richard Lavely in Detroit. He told us he was a janitor, a Republican, and a regular listener.
My opinion of the current state of the union is that we've favored the banks a bit too much. And I am, I think, generally opposed to the health care that Obama is after. Kind of glad we got our Republican majority, or at least control back a little bit.
Our friend Gustavo Arellano has his own soapbox. He's already a columnist and journalist, but he's trying to stay positive about the next 12 months from out there in Southern California.
My state of the union is one that's bleak, but one that's also lined with hope. It's bleak immediately because both my parents have been now unemployed. They were unemployed most of 2009. They continue to be unemployed. But I'm an optimist. How can you not be an optimist when you're the child of two Mexican immigrants who came here with next to nothing, and even though they're unemployed, they were able to buy a house early on in their life where they're in no danger of losing that house. Even if everything went to hell, we would still have that house.
Give us a call with your State of the Union at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it at thetakeaway.org. And it's great because we're already hearing from many of you.
Paul from Brooklyn. My take is the State of the Union is irrelevant. Look out for number one.
Barbara writes on our site, thetakeaway.org, dragging Republican anchor but inching forward. And Dennis writes, jobs, jobs, jobs. Jobs produce confidence.
You can reach us on Facebook as well over at our fan page. Daniel writes, rich get richer, poor get poorer. And Louis posts, going to hell, blame Pat Robertson. Coming up, we're going to peek at what ideas transportation experts have for improving the state of the union. Our correspondent Andrea Bernstein joins us to report in just a few minutes.
Coming up, how would you like to travel to work every day in a hot lane? We're going to be talking about that and some other sexy ideas about transportation in just a few moments. But first, here's some news.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's very spicy. We're going to check on the news stories you're following at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama will use his first State of the Union address on Wednesday night to focus on creating jobs and addressing the deficit. He'll set the tone later this morning when he announces a series of economic initiatives aimed at helping struggling middle-class families. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Bruce Reed, the CEO of the Democratic Leadership Council, who told us the president will be looking to send two messages on Wednesday.
He needs to lay out his priorities for the year on how to help the middle class with jobs and help for college and finishing the job on health care. And then second, he needs to reassure Americans that he wants to make government better, not bigger.
And we're asking listeners to give us their own impressions. Can you describe the state of our union in 6 words or less? To do that, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. International aid workers are now setting up tent cities outside Port-au-Prince for earthquake refugees, but there's a shortage of tents, with hundreds of thousands more needed. This wealthy Haitian businessman says the earthquake was a leveler in more than one way.
People that has no home and no residence and nowhere to go, they call this earthquake the most democratic event that ever happened in the history of Haiti, even more democratic than all the election we had.
The international community has pledged more than $1 billion in emergency aid, and the organizers of Friday night's Hope for Haiti telethon say that event raised more than $57 million.
A new message this weekend from the world's most wanted terrorist.
من أسامة إلى أوباما سلام على من اتبع الهدى.
It's reportedly Osama bin Laden on Al Jazeera over the weekend. He claimed responsibility for the Christmas Day bombing attempt in Detroit, but no indication he had any prior knowledge of that. At the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, a famous Picasso will have to undergo repairs after a woman accidentally lost her balance and fell into it. The mishap left a 6-inch tear in the painting entitled The Actor. Checking the markets now, a big bounce back. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 70 points. The S&P up about 9 points, and the NASDAQ is up 1607. Wall Street just getting underway. Futures are bouncing back, and we'll see if the trend holds for later on this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following today.
It's about the rich versus the poor, about backroom politics and multi-million dollar deals. So you think we're talking about bank bailouts? No, we are not. This is about transportation, and it's not your grandfather's highway anymore. Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein has all the details. Andrea, you just returned from a conference of 10,000 transportation officials in professionals in Washington, D.C., and one of the hot topics was hot lanes. What is a hot lane?
Good morning, Celeste. What's happening is that the federal government has not very much money. It has even less consensus. So what you are seeing is all of these transportation innovations are coming at the local level. So you will see states like Minnesota has right now the so-called hot lane. And what it does is it charges you, a lone driver, for the privilege of driving faster in the HOV lane.
The carpool lane.
The carpool lane. And they have technology so that you can look and see how much it's going to cost you. You can look over and see how much faster that lane's going. And if you want, you can drive into it. They argue that it's going to relieve congestion in all the lanes because everybody's going to move faster. But to give you a sense of, you know, how keen people are on their transportation innovations, I was speaking to the head or one of the people in the Minnesota Department of Transportation who is working on this project, Ken Buckeye. Here's our exchange.
The project, piece of the project north of 42nd Street into downtown Minneapolis is what we call a priced dynamic shoulder lane. It's an acronym. A PDSL is an acronym we created as we do that in
catchy
in our business. Not very, but we know what we're talking about.
And what we're talking about is rich people paying for the privilege of being able to travel faster.
Well, one of the things that people who advocate this argue is that people who ride a single vehicle or just one person in a vehicle in some of these lanes actually have the means to do this. And one of the big places that they're looking to do this is at the Lincoln Tunnel going into Midtown Manhattan in New York City. There are now four inbound lanes. One of them is for buses and carpools, and they say that one is getting too crowded. But even so, it's moving most of the people, 80% of the people, into the city in the morning. And I said, well, you know, the question that you asked, wasn't that just for the rich? And this is Mark Mariello of the Port Authority. They said, well, we study this issue.
You got to keep in mind this is a pretty high-income corridor, so people do have the means. And it's also a highly subsidized corridor where people have parking or vehicle operating costs that are subsidized by their employers.
Andrea, does the price change depending on how attractive the lane is?
It does.
Really?
In many of these things. You get like a sort of easy pass like device, a transponder in your car, and they can measure this, you know, in sort of 5-second or 5-minute intervals. And you know, they're looking at doing this all over the place.
But this
Silicon
is giving
Valley.
Up on the idea of forcing people to carpool.
No, actually what they say is that they're going to, because they're going to actually be turning more of the incoming lanes over to carpools and buses, they will be encouraging people to.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is what the traffic engineers
not buying
say.
It.
They say that the more that you charge for driving, period, the more people realize that it has a price and a value. Because you know, when you get
yeah,
to your car,
yeah, that works well with high prices of gas. Yeah,
yeah, but. When you get in your car, you don't pay per trip, right? When you get in a bus, you pay per trip usually.
Right.
So you think about it. Each time you get into a bus or a train, you think, okay, I'm paying for this. And the car thing is invisible to you. So what they're arguing, okay, is we're going to make this a little visible so you will see what you're doing and it will reduce driving.
Okay, so another thing that you heard about while you were there was bike sharing. What is a bike share?
Okay, so you're envisioning, okay, I'm going to get onto my bike, take a little bike, rent it out on a Sunday afternoon,
you know, bicycle,
go with my
two.
Family. But what they're talking about is a whole new mode of public transportation. And they already have this all over Europe right now where you can rent a bike by the hour, pick it up at a particular place, and return it to another place. And they're saying what it does is it's not just about biking and being healthier, but actually a new means of public transportation because it's such a cheap way of connecting different parts of the infrastructure, different parts of a city. You know, for example, if you were in Manhattan and you want to get cross town on public transportation, you're looking at 30, 45 minutes, depending on where you're going. On a bike share, on a bike, you can maybe get across town in 10 minutes.
But considering how bad the traffic is, you may not make it there alive on a bicycle.
Well, you know, what they want to do in a lot of these cities is put in really great bike lanes. And they're getting ready to do it right now in Boston. In Boston, it is coming in June. And I spoke to Nicole Friedman, who is setting up the program there, a former bike racer herself. This is how she says it works.
It's convenient. And I actually say it's hyper-convenient. A bike share station is every 300 meters throughout a city. That means for every transit station, you might have 3, 4, 5 bike share stations. And you can literally come up to a station, you swipe a card, and you take a bike.
That's a pretty cool idea. You know, and the amazing thing to me is how big transportation is right now. I mean,
yeah.
I can't remember another time when people actually knew the name of the transportation secretary, but I bet a lot of people know the name of Rayla Hood. Like, what's going on with transportation?
Because we're at a crossroads right now. So much of carbon emissions come from cars. So much of a family's budget goes to paying for getting around. That the decisions that we make now in this country are going to affect how we spend money and how we emit carbon gases over the next 50, 60 years. So the infrastructure is crumbling, and people are beginning to realize that we have to change the way we do things or else face increased sprawl, increased congestion.
Which will really change the way we do things.
Exactly.
It could potentially, or not, depending on the choices we make right now.
Thanks so much, Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein. Coming up, the State of the Union is this week, but what's the state of health care reform?
Well, what we really need to do is start over.
Oh, God, that's Senator Mitch McConnell. That's what he thinks, starting all the way over from the beginning. We're going to go more in depth with the New York Times' David Leinhardt later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. And on this show, we've reported a lot about drug smuggling and how it's affected communities along the U.S.-Mexico border. As difficult that is, either in Mexico or the U.S., imagine having your community straddle that line. That's the situation for the Tohono O'odham Nation, a Native American reservation that sits in both Arizona and Mexico. Eric Ekholm is a national correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So, Eric, what's happening in the Tohono O'odham Nation?
Well, they straddle 75 miles of border. Some of the residents live across the border. But it was sort of a weak point in terms of the drive against smuggling, both of people and increasingly of drugs. And as enforcement cracked down in California and Texas and other parts of Arizona, more and more of the drug smugglers, especially marijuana, started using the reservation as a transit point.
Well, the federal government is praising the Tohono O'odham Nation's cooperation with them as they start to pour more marshals in there and crack down on what is marijuana smuggling. But the residents there say they're afraid to leave their homes. They can't go out and collect food that they get, traditional foods out of the desert. It seems to be impacting their daily lives.
Very much so. It's a very strange atmosphere there, especially at night. Almost no one goes out. People are afraid there are, you know, possibly armed smugglers coming through, large groups of migrants, and at the same time, it's crawling with Border Patrol agents in trucks and on foot, and the tribal chairman called it a militarized zone. It's a very unpleasant and difficult situation for the tribal members who traditionally have been, it's a rather private tribe, insular. They're not used to a lot of outsiders, and now people are afraid of getting stopped. You know, if they drive out at the wrong time, wrong place, they might get stopped by the Border Patrol, but they also might come across a cache of drugs and be in danger from that. And others, you know, are lured by the money. It's a very poor place with massive unemployment. You can make several thousand dollars by agreeing to store marijuana or drive it out of the reservation. There are checkpoints everywhere, so it's a very odd situation.
And clearly there's a lot of kind of mixed feelings from the residents there. I mean, what did you get from most of them? Are they angry about the presence of all the law enforcement officials, or are they more afraid of the drug smugglers?
Well, I think most people there recognize that something has to be done so that the drug cartels don't just take over, and it's very sad to see there are families in which both parents have gone to prison and the children are raised by their grandparents. At the same time, most people have had the experience of being stopped and maybe searched or questioned by the Border Patrol, and they hate that too. So it's really kind of a no-win situation for them. They're caught in the middle for a problem that they didn't create.
And unfortunately for the Tohono O'odham Nation, that's also had to deal with all kinds of visa issues and everything else as they straddle that international border. This is just another problem there. Eric Ekholm, thanks so much. He's the national correspondent for the New York Times.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, is there a drawing board to go back to on healthcare reform? David Leinhardt is going to talk with us. He's from our partner, the New York Times. And what's the latest on the recovery efforts in Haiti? We'll go to Port-au-Prince. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at just about 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama will reportedly use his first State of the Union address on Wednesday night to refocus his presidency after some recent attacks. The New York Times says the speech will touch on job creation, the deficit, and helping middle-class families. This morning, the president is going to roll out several economic initiatives, including limits on student loans and some expanded tax credits. There's a meeting on Haiti's reconstruction strategy. It's going on in Montreal. At least 150,000 people died in the quake. Many, many more are in need of reconstruction help, and that's the strategy that they're talking about there in Montreal. But from the abstract up in Montreal to the concrete on the ground in Port-au-Prince, Adam Minot, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, is in Port-au-Prince now and brings us the latest. Adam, good morning, and what are you seeing this morning?
Well, it's a really continuing picture of people trying to recover from the devastation. I'm alongside one of dozens, hundreds of these temporary camps that have been set up by homeless people in Port-au-Prince. What people have done is they've grabbed what they could from what was left of their destroyed houses. They've formed temporary shelters. And really, they're waiting. They're waiting for international relief in the form of food and water and medical supplies. And they're waiting to see what happens to the rest of their lives. Their homes are destroyed, they have no jobs, they really have a very, very bleak future. There are still issues here with getting food and water out. A lot has come into the country, but there are still many tens of thousands of people who've seen no international aid. And at this camp here, this has been set up now for the past 12 days, they haven't seen any food being brought in. So there are some big problems facing them and big problems facing the operation.
Adam, you mentioned temporary shelters. That's really an urgent issue because hurricane season is coming and the rains start in just a few weeks. So what's temporary shelter for Port-au-Prince?
Very temporary. As you say, the shelters they're constructing are literally made from bits of wood and recovered bits of plastic. You're right, that weather issue is pressing. But really, people are simply in a position of clinging on to life. They're grabbing what food they can. They're sharing what they have with other people. And they know that the coming days and weeks are going to be bleak, and they're going to require all the resources that these people have.
Adam Minot, a correspondent for our partner, the BBC, standing in the midst of the refugee agony in Port-au-Prince.
In other news, in Ethiopia, Ethiopian Airlines plane carrying 90 people has crashed into the Mediterranean Sea shortly after takeoff from Beirut. The Boeing 737 crashed during a night of lightning storms. At least 23 bodies have been recovered. Lebanese officials don't suspect terrorism. And in Iraq, police say the death toll has jumped to at least 31 following three blasts in a hotel district in downtown Baghdad. Also in the country, a government spokesman says Saddam's cousin, Chemical Ali, has been executed. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So, after losing the 60th vote in the Senate, Democrats went into super slow-mo mode as far as health care reform is concerned. The president still thinks it's a priority, and there are some in the Senate, including Dick Durbin from Illinois, who believes the clock is still ticking.
For those who say, start over, let's start at the beginning, let's do a little bit, let's maybe do nothing, some say, I would just tell them, if we do nothing, the Medicare Trust Fund will be exhausted in 7 years. The plan we have before the Senate would extend the life of Medicare for 9 more years. If we do nothing, there'll be 57 million Americans uninsured instead of 47 million in just a few years.
Well, the future of Medicare is just one of the things we want to talk about with David Leonard, economics correspondent and columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you, John?
So we famously have heard over these past several months that healthcare is a sixth of the economy. That puts it squarely in your bailiwick. Is there a virtue in starting over, and where could this go from here?
If they start over, we're not going to get much of a health reform bill, and there are two main reasons for that. One, the Republicans are not really interested in working with the Democrats on this. We've seen that over the last year, and there's no reason to think that changes now because their strategy has worked pretty well politically. So I don't think they're going to start working with the Democrats now on this. And the second reason is it's really hard to do pieces of health reform. Let's say you tell the insurers they can't select people based on pre-existing conditions. Well, then you have the problem that a lot of the sickest people will be the ones signing up for insurance, and the cost of insurance goes way up. And the way you deal with that adverse selection is you mandate everyone gets insurance, so you don't have just the sickest signing up. But if you mandate everyone gets insurance, then you need to give people subsidies, and then you end up with a bill that looks a lot like what the Senate and the House have passed. And so if we start at the drawing board, we're going to end up with a really narrow, far, far, far more minor bill than what we've had so far.
So let me just recapitulate. If you don't do mandates, the cost goes way up because the sickest people get involved. If you do mandates without subsidies, it won't necessarily be effective, and you'll end up with an unfunded mandate anyway, kind of like the Medicaid problem that the states are dealing with. What sorts of policy issues in the current bill can be preserved and moved forward?
You can do little things. I mean, after the Clinton health reform changed, they did SCHIP, right? They made it a lot easier for poor kids to get insurance, and you can come up with smaller subsidies. You can put in some regulation of the insurance companies so that, for example, there are lifetime caps on how much people can spend over the course of their lifetime. But none of that deals with the two fundamental problems we have with healthcare, which is, one, it's so expensive that it's sapping workers' wages and that it's causing Medicare to go broke and it's creating all these problems. And two, which is really in many ways an outgrowth of one, we have tens of millions of uninsured people. And so we could get a bill that does some little things here and there, but we're not going to get a bill that deals with those two fundamental problems if we start from the drawing board and do something really small.
Well, if you listen to the president last week, he genuinely sounded upset and kind of heartbroken over all this. I guess I'm wondering why, at the end of the day, there isn't more clarity about what we need to do or when we need to do it. It seems to me this whole debate and the way that it was run has given us a lack of clarity, a sense of frustration, and a lot of independents just walked away.
Well, I mean, health reform was always going to be a messy process, right, for a couple different reasons. One, as some people like to point out, legislation is unpopular and programs are popular. So the mere process of crafting legislation is never something that really gets voters excited or quite frankly, even happy. It involves horse trading. No one really knows what's going on. And so it's clear at this point, in retrospect, but I also think it's clear to criticize the White House and Congress on this. They just took too long on this. And I don't know that there's a way to run the legislative process that would be a lot more popular. They just let it drag out for too long. Now, some people think that because there isn't some great secret solution that works a lot better than the legislation that we just got to, some people think that at the end of the day, the House is going to look at this Senate bill, and they're going to say, wait a second, this bill covers 30 million people, well more than half of the projected uninsured. And not only does it do that, but it more than pays the $1 trillion in costs for covering those people. In fact, over the next 20 years, it reduces overall health spending by $1 trillion, despite adding all these new people into the system. And are the Democrats really going to vote down this bill or not vote it up in the House because the House has been mistreated by the Senate during this process?
So that's the no re-vote scenario in the Senate. You say fear by Democrats in the House of doing nothing will motivate them to come across and actually put this into law?
I'm not saying it will. I'm saying that if you want to come up with a scenario in which this still actually happens and passes, it's that. It's that House Democrats look at this and they say, we're going to cover 30 million people. We're going to do it while reducing the deficit, according to what the CBO says. And we still wouldn't vote for this bill because it's not our first choice. At the end of the day, when that's the choice, and it is the choice, some people think the House, there's a chance that the House is still going to approve this.
Well, we'll see if the president in his Wednesday State of the Union address can actually raise the voltage of that fear among Democrats in the House. David Leonhard, New York Times economics columnist, thanks so much.
On our site, we have a whole bunch of extras for you. You can read a blog post with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen's Reflections on the Super Bowl. That's at thetakeaway.org. We're also looking ahead to the State of Union the Union address later this week, and we're talking with people like General David Petraeus. But we also want to know what you think is the State of the Union. Dan emails us, too much me, not enough we. Deanna emails, political maneuvering trumps common sense. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our site, thetakeaway.org. If you want to be creative, try to do it in just 6 words or less. That's the number you can also call to reach us, because we're always looking for your suggestions on who's having a good week or a bad week. We do that every Friday.
This is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's been a doubly burdensome week with the election in Massachusetts and the Supreme Court decision. I feel that it moves us, the people, even farther away from what's going on in Washington.
So I guess it's a bad week for the people of the United States. Give us your nominations at 877-8 on My Take, then tune on Friday to look back at the week with our friends of the Week magazine. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Welcome. 4 hours in New York. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.